This is Leo for KTWH Two Harbors Community Radio. I have in the studio with me today, I'm excited to have the naturalist at Gooseberry Falls State Park with us today, and that is Michaela Rice. Michaela, welcome to KTWH, welcome to the North Shore, and welcome to Gooseberry Falls State Park, where you're fairly new on the job. You want to tell people about how you came to be resident naturalist at Gooseberry?
Thank you.
Your whole life story.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'll try to keep it succinct, but I am a Minnesota native and have since undergrad, I mean, even before then, I was a nature nerd and always kind of getting in trouble for catching animals out in the backyard and coming home smelling like garter snake pheromones and bugs and all that stuff. And so
distinct odors sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. So I think it comes a little bit naturally just because I've been trying to tell people about nature my whole life and it finally caught up with me and I was like, okay, well, I have to do this for my job now. It kind of hit me. I was like, how has it not been this obvious the whole time? I was just so focused on trying to look at things from a very, very hard science perspective. And I loved animal handling. It's kind of a skill that I have, but now I'm trying to do that as my hobby and not as my job. You know, I've been volunteering at the Raptor Center with the U of M for over three years now. And so that, you know, those hobby type things are becoming really important to me, but it doesn't have to be my job. You know, I see critters all the time at work now, but it's more about just explaining the world and getting people connected to nature, which I'm very passionate about. And yeah, I recently transferred from the farmland region of Minnesota. I had our office down in Medelia, so I was working for the Fish and Wildlife Research Unit and recently transferred to Parks and Trails. And so, yeah, now I'm back. The North Shore has been a very important place in my young adult kind of formative journey. And so I'm very happy to be back up here.
Wow. So you've been coming up to the North Shore for a good long part of your life?
Yeah. I mean, ever since I was in diapers, my parents, you know, we'd come up here for vacation. My dad has some family up in the Silver Bay area and stuff. Okay. His family, you know, was mining iron a long time ago.
Yeah.
And so we'd come up to the North Shore. And then when I was in high school, I started going on Boundary Waters trips and got to do the Grand Portage and a big trip in the Boundary Waters. And yeah, it's been a very special place to me ever since. So I'm happy to be living up here now.
You were telling me that your odyssey and you were a research wildlife biologist. It took you all the way to Texas at some point. Was that it for school itself?
It was. Program? Yeah, I went down there. There's not a lot of programs that do large animal research. And I was also interested in genetics and it even had a stress hormone component to it. So that was on white-tailed deer. I even lived in San Diego for a summer. I was doing research at the San Diego Zoo Institute for Conservation Research that was on burrowing owls. And that's what really started me, got me really hooked on wildlife research. That was when I was an undergrad. And then I was searching out animal research options from then and got involved with the DNR, decided I have to go to grad school to do what I want to do. And then it brought me back to the DNR after, and I was studying deer. And then here I am now as a naturalist and get to talk about all the cool critters and plants. And
so you've seen it from the academic side and from the viewpoint of the visitors in the park and how you make the connections work for them, because as we were saying before to one another before the interview, that sometimes the jargon, the lexicon, can kind of get in the way of people understanding what you're talking about. You start talking about anadromous fish and their eyes glaze over until you say, I mean salmon or I mean steelhead.
Yeah, I mean, a big overall kind of issue in science in general is communicating scientific knowledge to people, you know, and getting past that jargon and being able to code switch between scientific language and then putting it in a way that people can connect with and understand and still understand the scientific aspect. But and then, you know, the goal as a naturalist is also to get people emotionally cued in to what's going on, because that's what promotes empathy and that's what is going to drive conservation in the end. If you have an emotional connection to the plants and animals around you, you're going to be way more likely to make choices and to make decisions that are going to benefit the world around you, right? Because you have a sense of empathy and compassion towards them. So that's my new goal. And I want to also tell stories of some of these vulnerable animal, plant communities, other communities, tell their stories and help conservation in that way and promoting underserved communities, whether that's animals or people that use the land that, you know, their stories aren't told very, very often either. So lots of stuff.
Wow. Well, we're speaking today on KTWH with Michaela Rice, who is, as you hear, has put a lot of thought into her position as the new naturalist at Gooseberry Falls State Park. And you're coming in, Michaela, right after a period where that position had not been filled for some time. We had this little thing called the COVID pandemic, which I bet just completely upset the apple cart of how park naturalist programs were happening for a couple of years. So what have you found? Or have you resumed doing the kinds of naturalist experiences that Gooseberry had been doing, or has there been a rethinking, or rolling out new ideas of your own? And, you know, how much does the park have something in mind and you're trying to coalesce and balance, you know, what's traditional with what you might bring for your ideas?
I think I come in a very unique perspective because I haven't been in a naturalist in the parks division through the pandemic. I was in research during that time, so I'm coming in looking at things way differently. I'm really lucky that my park and my supervisors and stuff, they don't have expectations. Everyone's just, oh, I'm so happy we have a naturalist back. So that's been really exciting. And everything that I've kind of proposed, everyone's just like, yeah, like we're just happy to have someone here and that can answer questions. You know, we had this hoverfly emergence explosion situation last week, and we had visitors that were literally screaming. We had kids crying in the parking lot thinking that the bees were going to come and, you know, eat everyone alive. And so they were glad I was there to just explain that they were flies and that we didn't need to panic.
Yes. So you noted that in an emailed kind of a mini newsletter that you've started already and have sent to your colleagues. What the heck is going on with these hoverflies? You said, well, guess what? Some of us people gardening just out in Clover Valley, 7 miles west of Two Harbors, we're walking by these Canada goldenrod and literally feel like pulsing waves of biology. Just the air is aflutter. I mean, and your first thought is, wow, are these stinging insects? I've been around a lot of pollinators and I'm pretty comfortable with they're just doing their job. And if I'm careful, but there are just so many that they couldn't all even fit on the heads of these goldenrods.
Yeah, I explained that they were literally dripping in these insects. And at the park, you know, we have the visitor center with a lot of windows, and it was 7:45, 8 o'clock in the morning, and these hoverflies were banging on the glass. It literally was like they wanted to come in and swarm us. And then I'd walk outside and they were covering me. They'd try to go down my shirt. And I think they were just looking for food. I literally think they all emerged. It was within about 36 hours we had noticed. And then the peak, they were flying everywhere. And that was the day that it was peak chaos. And now the hoverflies have kind of settled down. They don't chase me anymore or anything.
Have you been able to find out some things about them that aren't immediately obvious? Because we've never, in my recent time here, I don't remember anything like this volume of them. And so did I hear that they actually might be migrating?
I haven't been able to talk to anyone that knows. I've been putting posts on Facebook.
That was the case, that they were actually migrating and were forced downward to the ground, and that normally they'd been flying right past us as part of their life stage. And this is amazing to know that there is so much more still to be studied and generally understood by the average biologist.
Yeah, everything that I had been looking was that they do have emergence patterns and that they can be emerging at this point. And, you know, I am not great with insect life cycles. So, yeah, I've been trying to tap some people to get some answers, but everyone has said the same thing. We have never seen this before.
But some of the basics are they're pollinators, right? They're doing a good thing. And the other I read is that they are dynamic at consuming aphids. And for those of us that have had aphid infestations, this is like a very good coincidence that they've decided to show up in your gardens. So we go from panic to realizing that, yeah, this may be maybe once in a lifetime concurrence of this many of them, but that they're around. I mean, that they've been here. We just haven't ever dealt with them in this
quantity. And they've never heard us before. And yeah, I think maybe they could have benefit cleaning up some aphids. And I found a burdock plant yesterday on a hike, and the poor hoverflies, the burdock was covered in dead hoverflies. I think their legs got stuck to the thistle, the burrs on the top. You know, they're in flower right now, but they're still so sticky. So it was covered in dead hoverflies that got like stuck to it. But yeah, they are all over all of our native plants.
So for those at home that still don't know what Michaela and Leo are talking about, these hoverflies look a lot like the body of a bee, but they're not furry.
They're not smooth.
They have only two wings, a pair rather than two pairs, one behind the other on the thorax.
Very small antenna, those big compound fly eyes. You know, they act like flies. They'll sit on you. They'll clean their face. Their abdomens are flatter than bees.
Okay.
And I haven't really been able to visualize a lot of pollen on them because they aren't furry, like you said, but they're clearly dispersing pollen, but they are after the nectar. They are just feeding.
Right.
They're gorging themselves.
They're feeding. They're incidentally pollinating along the way. Okay. Mm-hmm. And if people are wondering, my idea of inviting Michaela on, in addition to welcoming her here and hearing about her story of coming on board as the new naturalist at Gooseberry Falls State Park, was to also talk some late summer, early fall phenology. And we've got the young kids at North Shore Community School that will be telling us about things that they see from their school bus and in their backyards. But I figured you might be able to give us, and I'm sorry to hold you to this tough standard of maybe some of the story behind the story of things like this time of the year, we have a lot of food products that are like, it's called mast. That's a word that baffles me. I've heard it a few times, never looked it up, and I realize, so I'm talking about acorns and hazelnuts and other things that are really fundamental subsistence stuff for some of the critters that got to make it through the winter, right?
Yeah, the birds are eating it. You know, we think of all the different berries on the fruit trees, like the viburnum around, you know, those beautiful, red, orange, and then the mountain ash. So mast is, you could think of nuts, fruit, the samaras, the helicopters, that's a source of food too. Yeah, bears and the chipmunks, and we see the grouse. Everything's just in the kind of almost that hyperphagia stage right now, just eating. But yeah, we think of mast. A lot of it grows on trees, but fruits for other animals. We can't eat a lot of it, but that's their
And we can't always get to it in a timely way.
Yeah.
We are trying to grow hybrid hazelnuts at my house, and getting them before the squirrels get them, not going so well for us, because we want the nut to be ripe, right, inside of its shell. Well, the squirrel's always the first to know it's time to harvest.
Yep.
And overnight, they're gone.
They'll clean a tree. Yeah, it's crazy.
So we're talking about those amazing processes that are happening in late summer into fall, and we still have a lot of flowering plants. What do you see at Gooseberry, for instance, in the last week or two that are still hanging on? Because we've lost a lot of the flowers are well past their prime or gone, and yet others remain and will persist
past
frost.
You know, infamous fireweed is, there's some plants with just a few left, that bright purple, and you know, we say when you get to the top of the raceme that fall's here, summer's over. We still got a few left on those. But the goldenrod, you know, we have, I think, 11 species throughout Minnesota, but I've been counting, you know, 5 or 6 species at least are in bloom right now. The different asters, the large leaf aster with the light purple pretty color, that's really prominent. The obedient plant is really in full bloom at our park. And we have some marigolds out on the shore. Joe pieweed, I see. That's, you know, a pollinator favorite. So I've just been amazed. Our Monarda and our Rudbeckia and sunflowers are still all blooming there as well. So we got tons of gold and some pinks and the dogbane and the sarsaparilla. And the honeysuckle is what's starting to turn that purpley maroon and yellowy kind of on the ground. And then we got just a few little bulbs that are starting to turn pink, but nothing really fall color-wise. So I'm going to save my little explanation of
I was giving you that assignment by email, and I thought maybe it's premature because I think it's the last week of September that we really call serious time for leaf change, and I didn't know. It didn't seem like this was an early year. There were very few flaming red maples in mid to late August, but maybe you're seeing some along the shore?
They're the mountain maples, and it's mostly I see the bright orangish red, the helicopter, the samaras that are turning.
That's what I see at my house is the samaras, but not so much the leaves yet. Sometimes a red maple will turn brilliant red on August 15th or 20th, and you go, okay, it's going to be a long winter.
I don't know if that's simplistic to say it that way. So we'll leave that little teaser, you know, for next time.
But another rite of passage, of course, for the natural world is migrations. Before there's hibernation, there's lots of migrations. So can you tell me a little bit about what you think is? I know that I saw nighthawks coming and going just about 10 days ago, and I think they're gone.
I know people have been, I mean, the cedar waxwings are kind of, they're just acting funky because they are having a lot of window strikes. So I know they're moving, and some of the other passerine birds, in terms of bigger migration patterns, I don't see anything out at the park. I got to talk to Hawk Ridge. I'll do that as homework too, to see where they're kind of at, if they've had any raptors move through. So I'll have an update soon on that, but I haven't really seen a lot of birds at the shore.
Right. And then the other things that we talk about as migrants include those charismatic insects like the monarch butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of observations did you make? Were there monarchs along the shore in the park?
I have seen two monarchs this whole summer, so I don't know. It's made me sad. I have seen
Were they eating on milkweed, or how did you just flying?
No, they were flying. I think maybe they were on some monarda. We have some, you know, random bee balm throughout the park.
Sure.
And so, no, not even on milkweed. So I don't know what's going on with the monarchs. I presume, you know, it's kind of windy at our park too. I don't know if they can hang out for too long sometimes, but I have not seen many butterflies at all.
Yeah, and there has been plenty of wind. I hope that is not the primary reason we haven't seen them. A lot of us who have invested in trying to grow more milkweed are alarmed that we've put a few years into this. Some people I know spent a lot of time getting more milkweed, and there were some reports that there were a good number of caterpillars among their milkweed, but not so much at our house at all in terms of seeing flying monarchs or caterpillars. So
yeah, I agree.
Yet we've been rich, again, inland with hummingbirds this year. I don't know if hummingbirds are typically shore visitors to the...
I haven't seen them there either, but I have heard people say that hummingbirds have been moving through their yards, so maybe the hummingbirds are kind of moving south right now.
We've got the feeders out, and they're still there, Michaela. So sometime soon, I know the Brimson area, inland from us, here in Two Harbors, had 31.3 degrees on Sunday morning, it was. So it's not going to be long before the hummingbird's metabolism says, I need to go where it's warmer.
I also monitor bat boxes, so I'll be able to keep you updated on what the bat activity, because depending on the species and kind of the weather, you know, they could change their roosting patterns, they could congregate in my boxes, they could leave, they could be doing some things, and, you know, bats hibernate, and it's quite cute to see a bat hibernating. They just are so peacefully asleep, and you can get close to them and see how fuzzy they are. Oh, and little mice will chew their ears off.
What?
And yes, and the bats they can't even wake up to defend themselves.
Oh my.
So, yeah.
I did not know about that one. That seems a little devious. Boy.
Yeah.
Well, I've enjoyed kind of getting to know you, Michaela, at least with the radio audience today. And let's try to make this a semi-regular event, and we'll be in touch about how we do that. And you'll start studying up on all of your leaf change chemistry, right?
Yes. Give me homework. I can do it.
It's a pop quiz coming up soon. Well, thanks for joining us today, Michaela, on KTWH. And it's great to have you on the radio, and we'll see you again.
Thank you.
Bye now. This is Leo for KTWH.